Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Eat me.
All right, you have tuned into the Heritage Radio Network. You're listening to a special studio recording. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and we are live in studio with the lovely Frances McDormand. Frances, welcome to Bushwick.
Thank you so much, lovely Erin.
It's great to have you here. So you did say before we jumped on the mic that you wanted to reserve the first question. I want to honor that request by ceding the mic.
Thank you, Erin. What kind of beer am I drinking, please?
That is a great question, and I don't know the answer.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to guess, though, that it is the... Jack, what is the six-point special sweet relief?
Six-point get safe.
Get safe.
Get safe.
It's get safe. It's a special blend from Six Point Brewery. They're a brewery in Brooklyn, and they brew it just for Roberta's.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's just good, right?
Get safe's nice.
Jack, I think we're going to need a beer on backup for Frances.
Yeah. I'm almost done, baby.
I can tell.
Bring it in, Jack.
So... We brought you in the studio. We were kind of thinking about your most recent role as Sue Tomlinson from the film Promised Land. And, you know, we've done a lot of coverage of fracking here on the radio. And I know that you're not a fracking expert. So I'm just curious, you know, it's a very socially minded film. You guys took a pretty aggressive stance. And what was it that attracted you to the role?
I think it's interesting. I'm not going to answer your questions. First, I'm going to say I think it's interesting you thought it was an aggressive stance. I thought it could be a little more aggressive. But, you know, any Hollywood movie about a social commentary about something that's happening in our country is a pretty aggressive stance, unfortunately, at this juncture. Not many movies like that are made. So it was in that tradition.
Maybe that was my response more that also for me, I think it was really one of the first films that as an adult I've seen that dealt with an issue that I deal with and care deeply about. That's part of my generation. That wasn't some kind of historical film or reflection or kind of pulling out of some other space. You know, we're dealing with that here in New York State. I've talked to tons of people, you know, farmers, restaurateurs across the gamut. So maybe it just felt aggressive because it was...
Even being talked about.
I was shocked, mm-hmm. quite frankly. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting. I think that a couple things that I think are happening now. I know that my son was studying fracking in 8th grade science class. And I got on the elevator in our apartment building on the Upper West Side of Manhattan and said to a couple people on the elevator, do you know what fracking is? And no one did. And I said, ask your 10-year-olds. They're learning about it. You better catch up. So I think that there's a real kind of socioeconomic divide between the people who know about those things and who don't. I also think that there's also a different disconnect in terms of filmmaking. There's a difference between feature narratives and documentaries. And documentaries have crossed over into a whole other world of filmmaking and audiences. You know, until Michael Moore, documentaries weren't seen in theatrical runs. You didn't get to go to the mall and see a documentary. You had to kind of track them down, or you saw them once a year in one theater. So the idea that a film can really teach anything that the public doesn't already know a lot about is subversive. The idea that a lot of people are going to see this film and not know what fracking is, is pretty extraordinary. So my opinion as a 55-year-old is that a feature film doesn't teach anybody anything. But in fact, I think this one does, unfortunately.
So was that why you chose to be a part of it? Or
no, I didn't choose to be a part of this film because of fracking. Because my opinion is that feature films don't teach anything, don't give a fair view of anything. I got involved of it because of the people.
And so, you know, you work in feature films. I mean, I know that you're involved in a lot of other projects as well, but I think to the general public, like, that is how we know you. So, I mean, how is your craft or the way you spend a lot of your time reflective of...
My political stance?
Not your political stance, but, you know, you're spending a lot of time there. So if it's not the socially conscious drive to, you know, what is it about working in film that keeps you there, that, you know, is engaging? Because you do it a lot. So
yeah, well, I see it as a service position. It's a really active service position. It's much better than going into the military. In a way, I get to see the world. I get to test my skills over and over again in different situations. And in this one, I get to test my skills in terms of this. It's as close as more than in any other way that I've gotten to my political beliefs. But I also am very, very careful of keeping my personal political beliefs out and away from my work, because it is not. I can do a lot more personally than I can professionally. When it really comes to changing something, this movie isn't going to change anything. If anything, it's only going to feed a machine that's already in place. That's my personal opinion. That's why I don't do press and publicity.
So, I mean, I think about this a lot when people in positions like yours, where, you know, you have this kind of opportunity to use your powers for good, and like where, you know, you have a voice. And so it sounds like you don't do press and publicity. You don't kind of choose roles based on your political stance. So, I mean, are you kind of subversively?
I believe so. Look at Sue. Look at Sue, the character. As written, Sue was, if you look at, you know, screenplays for film have very limited genres. I see this kind of, not, it's not unlike another film I did called Mississippi Burning, which was about quote unquote the civil rights movement in the 60s in the South, in the American South. But really, if you broke down the screenplay, not unlike Promised Land, Promised Land's a buddy movie. Mississippi Burning is a cowboy, is a Western. Two white guys ride into town. You never get to know any black character's name. You never get to hear their story. It's about two white guys riding into town. Nothing happens dramatically until a white woman is beat up, and then they go into action. Now, it's okay if a lot of black characters are lynched and beaten and killed, but it's not until a white woman gets beat up that something happens. Not unlike this, this is a buddy movie, and Sue is the buddy.
Yeah.
So it's how you take a buddy role and try to subvert it. So I subverted it by showing that Sue's the bad guy. Sue's the bad guy because Sue is on the fence and has got one foot in one side and one foot in the other and keeps walking down the middle.
It was hard for me to watch, quite frankly, because I kept going back and forth. You know, there's all these scenes with, you know, the Skyping with her kid and kind of the very sweet, like, I don't know, romance-y scenes in the, you know, gun store. And I think, though, that really touches on, like, the reality of people are kind of complex and put themselves in situations where they, gosh, they just make shitty decisions. And
yeah.
How do you get in and out of that?
Yeah. Yeah. You want a hero, look someplace else. You want to be a hero, it's complicated. There's no black and white. We're in gray. We're swimming in gray right now.
So in some emails that we exchanged before the interview, you were talking about greed.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to touch on that a little bit because You said it pretty powerfully. You felt like greed was just insidious in like our culture, and I'm wondering if you can expand on that a little bit and talk about what you meant by that.
Okay, and here, you know, I preface this, and I'm going to keep saying this, and remind me to say this, that okay. I have a beer in my hand, and I'm not an expert, and I have not done research, so you can't, you know, this is my personal opinion. There was a article in the last few months in the New York Times, which is a publication of record, that was talking about how the fracking industry was being fueled by the banks, and that there is a certain amount of drilling for natural gas that happens whether we need it or not, whether the demand is there or not, because it is a market-driven commodity. So that these companies who are fracking and who are drilling these wells have to come up, they have to constantly keep providing the natural gas for the market, not for the use of the natural gas. That is a major part of the problem, a major part of the problem, because it is about our capitalism is based, has gone from a supply and demand to a greed and demand, a demand, and we want more, more. And more and more and more. And I think that, you know, the people that I sat next to, the people who were in that gymnasium in the film whose farms are being leased and whose farms they hope will be leased, their land who they're hoping to lease, they've had natural gas wells on their property for a long time to supply their own natural gas needs for themselves. So that was in place when these large companies came in and said, you know what we're doing, you know it's not dangerous, let's keep doing it more. And you know, you can help out, and we're going to pay you for that, and this is what we're going to pay you. And these are people who don't have pensions. They don't have kids coming back to the farm to continue a farming community, a farming lifestyle that's not supportable. It's not sustainable anymore because of what they've been told to grow by large agricultural markets. I mean, it's insane. So I don't mean that those people are greedy, but we have a baseline of greed that's in place, a baseline of get it now. I've literally heard people my son's age who are 18 say, we better get it before it's gone. Oh, I'm just joking. Oh, no, I'm just kidding.
Right.
Okay? And so that's still in place. It's, you know, dance while Rome is burning. It's still the ethos, I think, of our culture.
Or
except maybe in Bushwick.
Yeah, who knows? I don't want to give us too much credit. You know, it's interesting. I'm from Northern Michigan. I was back home over the holidays and found out via my sister that my father had actually sold drilling rights to a company that does fracking to a piece of property that he owns. And so it was really fascinating for me to try and find a way to engage with him without, you know, kind of freaking out. Like, Dad, you know, what were you thinking? And like, how did they approach you? And what was the story and the sell? And one of the things I was really struck by in the movie was how well that the film really captured a lot of those kind of small town characters and this, I don't know, this like need for a solution in a place where there wasn't one. And then I think also this desire for something that was quick and easy. And I'm curious, you know, obviously you're here at the Heritage Radio Network. We do primarily food content. You know, you're a mom. And one of the kind of corollaries to this kind of fracking and gas and market supply, I think, is, you know, that you have the exploding obesity diabetes crisis in the U.S. And it's similarly like the spigot of processed shit food mm-hmm. is just on, you know, yeah. It's on. It's just on. It's just coming. And we're, I think, more and more seeing really drastic results of that. And I'm wondering, like, for yourself, for your family, mm-hmm. kind of how do you look at, you know, feeding yourself, nourishing yourself, and then kind of putting up barriers around that crap?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because both my spouse and I went through we were children of the 70s, 60s and 70s, and our parents lived through the Depression and then the supply that came after that. So the Depression was true, like a close, very, very, and still happening in America, a starvation. There was real starvation happening on American soil. So there was a real sense in my parents' generation where that was not going to happen again. And in combination with this kind of puritanistic, you know, you eat everything on your plate. But it was always about those starving kids in China.
Yep.
It was the starving children
in China.
Yeah. And look, how old are you?
I mean, 33.
Right. How's that still going on?
Well, I'm from the Midwest, so yeah, I think we're like...
It keeps going. There's always starving children in China. Well, guess what? There's starving children in the United States of America. And I think that there was this idea of we will never starve again, and we will never let you starve, but you better fucking know how lucky you are. So that, therefore, you eat everything on your plate. So now I'm raising a child. I'm raising him in great privilege. I can afford to give him any kind of food he wants. I was, you know, I only got to experiment as being a parent once, and so I was really dedicated to the idea of giving him the best of everything. He's a little fucking prince, I cannot tell you. But he also has an extraordinary palate, because if I put a pesto on anything, he would eat it. I just put pesto on it, he would eat it. There was a point culturally when he was probably in second grade, and he came home and he said, "Mom, can I have those little square things? I want those little square things."
Lunchables.
So we made our own Lunchables for a long time. I just made them. I cut good things into squares and circles and triangles. It was extraordinary how important it was for him just to do. He needed to have the same thing. You don't want to look around. And you know, you hear that over and over and over again. Everybody's talking about how they, you know, traded their liverwurst for the, you know, canned whatever. Something about being able to fit in. And unfortunately, that's the dominant culture. The dominant culture is processed food, and the thing to have in your lunch is processed food. It's not good homegrown food. But unfortunately, we are still working with a socioeconomic barrier. And, it's, you know, crazily, it came from farms were, what everything that's happening in Bushwick was happening in farms. It can't still happen in farms unless they have their, you know, you can do it in a garden. You can't do it in a farm anymore, because a working farm, to actually make any profit from a working farm, you can't grow real food. You have to grow something that can be fed to cattle or exported. But to grow real food, you have a garden, then you have to eat seasonally. And people aren't, they're greedy. They're not willing to eat seasonally. I just fear that, you know, it's more about it's gotten too big and too far away from the actual, you know, process.
Sure. So does the future look bleak?
Oh, my God. You see, I'm a fatalist / optimist. I believe that my son is going to survive, but it's not because he knows how to make guacamole, because he makes a good guacamole, but he doesn't understand still where that avocado comes from in the winter, that he can only have guacamole in a certain time of the year and in a certain place. And he still goes down to the market to buy it. He has no idea it comes off a tree, I don't think. I am a little bit of fatalistic. Yeah. Here's something I do want to talk about.
Okay.
So fracking's in place. Fracking's going to happen.
It is happening.
It's happening.
Yeah.
You know, they've snuck it in. We want to call it snuck in. It's happened. I think that a lot of our time and attention and money has to go into educating ourselves and the younger people that we care about into living in a world that they're not going to get what they want. They're not going to get what they want. They're not going to be able to find it, and they're going to have to figure it out communally. And that's what I see happening in these cultures here. Because I think that's the truth. It's not apocalyptic yet, but it's marginal. It has to happen. That's where the education has to start. It's not just the parents. It's not just a bunch of parents getting into a public school and changing it. If you're paying taxes in your neighborhood, if you're single,
which you are, everyone is. Everybody's
paying.
You can't avoid it. I've been, you know, like,
yeah.
You can't.
How much a month are you paying your taxes? Make sure that they're using it properly. You're not going to give that money to somebody and not, you know, care how they spend it. The school's a major place of tax revenue, and it has to be working.
Held accountable
is a really good phrase.
I want to jump
back. Can lead to fascism, unfortunately. Go ahead.
Hopefully not a direct line.
No.
I want to jump back into the acting world for a second and talk a little bit about craft tables and eating on set and on films. And you know, I think that there's a you know, for me, I have like, there's a public perception of like, oh, you're a big fancy movie star, like you can get whatever you want. And then there's like the whole rest of the cast. And But every time I walk past the craft table, it just looks like the worst shit. So what's going on? Like, what are you eating on a film? You're working on it for a long time. Do you pack your own lunch? Do you? How does that happen? And like, how is it different for people?
Well, I've seen it evolve over the years. And it also, I think I've seen it evolve over the years because it has to evolve given the budget of a film. I've worked on a lot of films, both low budget and obscene budgets. Low budget films, all the money goes to the film, and that literally means go to the film. Until now, that you're shooting digitally, and it's not necessarily going to the real thing called film, but the most important people to feed are the crew, because they're the ones that are usually there 15 to 16 to 18 hours a day. So actors, in fact, you know, fuck the actors. It's about the crew, because they're the ones that are there. If you're filming in a place like New York City, you don't spend a lot of your budget on catering, because they would much rather go around the corner and get great sushi or a slice of pizza. If you are landlocked somewhere in Alabama, and the only thing you have is Arby's, and you can't get to the good barbecue place, and there's not a lot of things to offer, then you've got to bring in a catering system. Some of the most interesting kitchens I've seen, it's kind of like Hidden Kitchens, the Kitchen Sisters, Hidden Kitchen thing. They come in with an RV that's tricked out, it's pimped out, and it's a great restaurant kitchen. And some of the most amazing meals I've seen have been produced out of this kitchen on wheels, where they've hooked into the local marketing supply, and that's the brilliance of those people. Not just that they can, you know, put out a meal for $300, but that they can also move into a town and find out the best place to get the best produce, the best meat, you know, and not be not be hooked in politically to the food supply, which is really tricky in small towns, because restaurants in small towns, I think, are really hermetic. So that's one way. It's those beautiful, you know, catering companies who put a lot of time into their trucks. But on a smaller level, it's the craft services. When you can't afford to get one of those big fancy trucks, and you're not in a place where people can go find their own food, the craft services become that person in the community who you can't believe comes up with these amazing meals for that many people. And it's usually fresh stuff. They cut up a lot of fresh vegetables. They make fresh soup. They make sandwiches. They know right when to feed you. So it's like that. It's like, you know, it's the grandma and the aunt and the uncle that know exactly how to do it.
What did you grow up eating? What did food look like in your household as a kid?
I grew up all over the Midwest and South, and in mostly rural areas, in a working class family. And my parents, up until we moved to Pennsylvania in seventh grade in 1969, in late 60s, they had a garden. Wherever we were, even in suburban Chattanooga, Tennessee, they would plant something in the backyard. There was this weird thing that used to happen at Easter time in Woolworths. They would have these little chicks dyed pink and blue, and they would give you them for your Easter.
Live chicks.
And then they would grow into big-ass chickens. And in Chattanooga, Tennessee, we had chickens in the backyard living in the doghouse. And then one day they were hanging from their feet, draining their blood from the clothesline. And I tell you, the neighbors were concerned. They thought there was some kind of santeristic happenings. But it's because, you know, you get a chick, it grows up to a chicken, you eat it. So there was still, until for a long time in my childhood, there was still a real agricultural aspect to the way we ate. My father was a minister, and there was a lot of bartering that would go on. He would be there in a hospice situation with someone who was dying. He would spend a lot of time with them towards the end of their life, and then the family would, there would be kind of weeks to months after that where bags of potatoes would show up, turkeys, just you pay back, and you pay back with food.
Yeah.
It's the currency.
It's also, one of the things that's interesting, going from a rural environment or an environment where you have that kind of tie-in with the seasons, I felt like growing up, it didn't occur to me that I was eating seasonally or locally. It was just like, yeah, this is, you go here to get the potatoes at this time of year because they're the best there, and grandpa's corn comes in at the end of July and August, and we bring some corn over to pick asparagus from wherever, and
yeah,
so it's and really integrated.
Yeah. And who does? And if you have that, I'll give you this. The other thing I remember, two things, when you're talking about processed food. My father also was also a lot involved in the what do you call it? Okay. So they have all this processed food that comes from the government. It's usually, at that time, it was a lot of it was left over from the Vietnam War. So you have huge blocks of American cheese. You have mm-hmm. canned stuff. You have all the stuff that was government grade, non-perishable food. They would distribute it to small towns, to food banks. And in rural communities, often the church would be, or the Elks Club, or the Lions Club, they would distribute this. So my father was in charge of distributing this, and then when there was leftover, he would bring some of the blocks of American cheese home. So we would have these always, and they would be in the refrigerator for months. The other thing was, my mother, even when we could afford ice cream, or she could make a cake, or there were things that were available for dessert, she still had a real taste. Every now and then she would take a glass, she'd break up white bread in it, she'd put white sugar on it and milk, and that was dessert, because that's what had become, it was a kind of like a very weak substitute for, I'm sure, what had become like fast bread pudding when she was a kid in the Depression.
Sure, and also just kind of making it work, essentially.
Making it work. But I don't think Wonder Bread with refined white sugar and pasteurized milk was probably as tasty as the milk bread and even the stale stuff she was getting as a kid. So it was kind of a ghost of some memory that she needed to comfort her.
Well, you're chasing flavors.
Chasing it.
I mean, is there anything like that you can't recreate as an adult or that you remember eating as a kid?
Well, I still attempt it. I think that's also what's interesting about the food culture of your generation. We're still going back to these weird American 50s things that signal some kind of innocent time when people were really connecting with their food culture. And it's macaroni and cheese and,
hamburgers, fries.
Hamburgers, fries. Look at Shake Shack. My God. Explosion. Pizza. Pizza is a working class, food of Naples. It's,
Ain't nothing fancy. For me, it's definitely fast food because I lusted after it so heavily as a kid.
Yeah.
My parents would never let us eat it. So now, I want the McDonald's to, be the way I remember it. Mm-hmm. But, it's not. That's over. That's over for me. I've let it go, but
it's
it was a process.
It's a good thing to let go.
So how about feeding yourself now? I mean, do you eat in restaurants? Do you cook at home? Like, what's your story?
Combination.
Yeah.
Combination of, I have to say the most gratifying thing is that my son cooks. He's 18. He has a limited repertoire, but a good one. And I love the fact that he feeds himself and has dinner parties. That's the way he socializes. He has people over and they cook stuff. And that makes that for me, that's I feel like 3/4 of our job.
You've accomplished
is
something.
Done. We accomplished. Yeah. So we eat, we probably cook at home 4 out of 7. If I can get the spousal unit to do a stir fry, I'm lucky. He does a good one, so that makes 5, and then we eat out. We eat out on a pretty we eat out regularly. Never as a family. We always sat down in a family until that became an issue. That became a really good way for our kid to push up against the authority, and then we stopped eating at the table probably a couple of years ago every night. But I really believe in that. I think the ritual of sharing food around a table is really important, with napkins and placemats.
Cloth napkins?
Yes.
How?
Cloth. And a bottle of shout-out.
Well, you heard it here first. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'm excited to learn what kind of projects and stuff you have on the horizon.
Yay.
Man, Joe, your computer is so slow, I can't even use this thing.
Yeah, I should probably get a new one. Do you have any suggestions?
Oh, totally, man. You should go to TechServe.
Okay, what's so good about TechServe?
Well, they've got this awesome new insider program that's free when you get a new Mac with AppleCare. So you should buy your computer there because you get 50% off data transfer, free loaner computers, front-of-the-line repair privileges, an annual Mac tune-up service, backup consultation and setup, seminars, and much more.
Okay, yeah, where's TechServe?
It's at 119 West 23rd Street in New York City. They're New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and service provider, and you should totally check out TechServe.com for more information.
All right, that settles it. I'm headed to TechServe.
You know, at the Heritage Radio Network, we work with a bunch of local musicians, and Jack is super tuned into the kind of DJ and electronic world.
Well, who was
and
that? Who was that? Jack?
That is a producer who goes by the name of Tom Cruise, actually. With a Z, though. C-R-U-Z.
Oh, my God. Thank God.
Yes.
I like, almost dropped my beer. What?
You didn't know he's also a musician. So you have tuned into the Heritage Radio Network. You are listening to a special studio session. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and we are in the studio with Frances McDormand, and we are about to talk present, future?
Past, present, and future work.
Awesome. So we have a couple of special guests in the studio. Do you want to do the honors?
May I introduce them? I'll start with Allison Rosa, who's a photographer in New York City and a friend of mine, and another friend of mine, Suzanne Bocanegra, who is a conceptual artist who I'm working with at present. So I'll start with the past. I met my friend Allison Rosa through a film called Friends with Money, written and directed by Nicole Holofcener. We met on the set of that film because I was playing a character based on Allison. And so we met, and we've been friends how long?
8, 9 years.
Speaking to the microphone. She's a photographer. She doesn't know how to do this.
8 or 9 years.
You can move it so it's a little comfier for you.
So we've been, we've been collaborating as artists and parents for 8 years. Because she has two kids. Her daughter is the same age as my son, and we commiserate on a daily basis. And, lo and behold, Suzanne Bocanegra, who I met through a really old friend from graduate school, Dare Club. Suzanne also has a son who's a year older than our two kids and has just started college, so we commiserate as well. Yeah. We've started a project, Suzanne and I, recently called Bodycast, which is an art lecture that I'm performing as Suzanne. And we've been working on it. We rehearsed today. And our first presentation is going to be at the Carnegie Mellon Museum in Pittsburgh.
How did you end up there?
Promised land.
Yeah?
Yes, because, now listen to this. This is good. I think it's good.
Okay, I don't know if I've heard this.
All right, so Lynn Zelovansky, who is the head... What do you call him? Not head.
She's the director.
The director of the Carnegie Mellon Museum in Pittsburgh used to live across the hall from me on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And then at that time she worked at MoMA. Then she moved to LACMA in L.A. And now she is the director of the Carnegie Museum. So when we were shooting Promised Land, I saw her and her husband, Paul. Hello, Lynn and Paul. And we started talking.
Shout out.
And she said, what are you doing? I said, I'm working with Suzanne Bocanegra. Oh, I love her work, says she. And I said, oh, well, by the way, we're looking for a place, museums around the country, because we want to do a little traveling artist lecture.
Traveling to art museums. Around the world.
Around the world, because we basically...
Want to travel.
We want to get out of the house.
We want to have fun.
Housewives have fun. So, but I, you know, a side thing about this is that when I was talking with Lynn about fracking, it was very interesting, and I'm going to out them.
Do it. You heard it here on the Heritage Radio Network first.
Should I?
Yes.
No, I've had too many
she's
beers.
She's your friend.
She's
your
my friend. I can't. Let's
you know
just
what?
Talk about it.
She's a very nice person. I read it in her bio that she was very nice, and it's true. Here, she had the opportunity, and
right.
She passed.
Okay, well, so she didn't pass. She's going to
no,
have
No, you
us.
Passed.
Yeah, I
you
passed.
You passed on outing.
Passed. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to say that I think that there's more to just the people leasing their land, farmers leasing their land. There's organizations that lease land for fracking that need to start thinking about it. So let's talk about Bodycast.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Oh, Bodycast. I was going to say something about fracking because there's something that I didn't mention this to you, but I went home to Texas to...
Ooh, a lot of fracking in Texas.
Yes.
And like earthquakes in Texas.
Yes.
Because
it's
of
crazy
it.
Crazy down there.
You know, well, I went down to visit my parents for Christmas, and my mom told me that she's been getting these checks in the mail for thousands of dollars. And for my parents, that's a big deal. And it's because of she didn't even know what fracking was. She just knew that some guy called her up and said, "Oh, we're prospecting for oil on this piece of property that your aunt had some sort of interest in, deceased aunt, and you're one of the heirs,
yeah.
One of the many heirs." And what many heirs, like cousins and all these people, are all getting this money. And I said,
so they're just getting it.
And
I
said, Mom, do you know what how they're doing that? And she had no idea. And you know, I have to say, you know, how's my mom? My mom's not the type who would
question.
No.
Yeah.
And also, if you're raised in Texas, you're used to this idea of, hey, we struck oil. Yeah. Sure. We're getting a tax.
You know, there used to be a TV show about it.
Yeah.
More than one, I think.
Lots and lots.
But also the thing, I said, Mom, did you ever think, if you're making that much money, how much are they making?
Right. See, that's the other thing.
And I could tell, you know, my mom's in her 80s. She's like, oh, I don't want to think about it. You know, it's like.
Sure, pick your battles.
The check in the bank. But that you know, it's the thing we were talking about, being a certain point. And what is the education? Is the education about fracking, which is clearly, it's gone. You know, that's gone. What's happening is that we are drilling holes into a very, very, it's not delicate. The earth isn't a delicate thing. But it can only sustain so much.
It's kind of delicate.
Yeah, I was just going to say it is.
It's just delicate.
Yeah. I mean.
No, I think we are. I think the earth is going to get rid of us so fast because we have fucked with it. Yeah. We are a pestilence on the earth. We're past blast us out.
That's true.
We're blasting ourselves out, I think. We're, like, literally inviting it. We're tempting fate. We're like,
yeah.
You know what? This shit's not happening fast enough. We're going to make it come right along.
See, that's what I mean. I think we give ourselves too much credit in thinking we can save it. We can't save it. We can't fuck it up until any more than it wants us to fuck it up. And I mean that the earth will come back. And because it's the larger, it's the grander thing. It was here a lot longer than came along. It's going to be here past us.
It already is coming back.
Yeah.
I mean.
It's going to start knocking us down.
It is.
Squishness. So the thing.
So body cast.
Yeah. So we're going to keep
I'm
doing.
In tears over here. I'm like, I don't know. I was feeling good.
Another beer. Jack, beer. So in the meantime, yeah. So in the meantime, what do? Do you make money or do you make art?
Yeah, well, we've chosen to make art.
That's what the 55-year-olds are doing.
Money or art?
Yeah.
No, art.
So, yes, we're definitely making art.
Bodycast.
We're definitely not making money.
So what is Bodycast?
Bodycast is an artist lecture, and it started because in 2010, I was asked to give an artist talk, you know, the slide talk at the Museum of Modern Art about my work. And I decided to, instead of the normal artist talk where you talk about your development as an artist like I did, you know, red paintings in 1995, and then I moved on to green, whatever, I decided that I would tell the story about how I became an artist growing up in Pasadena, Texas, in my wacky Catholic church and what happened there. And it's called When a Priest Marries a Witch. And after I'd written it and gotten it all together, I decided that I wanted to sort of frame it and move it outside of myself. And I asked the actor Paul Lazar to perform it as me. And we just did it as a one-off, you know. I mean, we ran through it once, and then we just, you know, did it. And
I saw that. I really loved it.
Well, you didn't see the first one.
No, but I saw an iteration of it.
Well, what happened was we did it once, and it was like, oh, that kind of was work. That's kind of interesting. So we kept doing it at different theater festivals and colleges, whatever. And that's, you saw it at Prelude Theater Festival in Manhattan. And then...
And what often happens with actors, you say, I want a piece of that. And I wanted to do it.
Well, also, I had part two. And so I was thinking, I thought Francis would be perfect for it because we're about the same age and there's a lot of things.
To me, you look exactly alike because I think everyone looks like Francis.
But I also was thinking of it in... You know, I learned a lot from doing the piece with Paul. And originally I wanted to cast a man because I wanted it to be clear to the audience that it wasn't me. But for the second one, I thought I wanted it to be more of a self-portrait. And in the same way that when you see, you know, old self-portraits from ages ago in museums, they resemble the person, but they're idealized. You are the idealization of me, Francis.
Yes, thank you.
And so I thought, honored. But I wanted it to, one of the things I also learned, which probably it's an obvious thing, by seeing Paul perform my lecture, is that he can pump it up and he can do things with the audience and he can turn a phrase that I just can't even dream of doing. Just the way he can project
an audience
himself.
Can perform.
Yeah.
And what's interesting for the transition also is because the first piece, When a Priest Marries a Witch, which is really good, it's more of a narrative story about something outside Suzanne's life that informed her as an artist. This one is more personal because, and it's called Body Cast, because between the ages of 12 and 15, she was in a body cast for scoliosis, and that informed her, which is the curvature of the spine, and that really informed her work. And by the way, since it's radio, she has completely straight spine now. Just
she
so
looks
you know.
Great.
She looks fabulous. But
the rest of us need to sit up, but yeah. She looks great.
That's really, it's an informative thing in anybody's life, but the way it informs an artist, and specifically Suzanne, is kind of cool.
I mean, the project sounds interesting on a couple of levels. Like, one, it's iterative to you, where you're kind of choosing different people to play yourself, but then for you as the performer, ultimately, like, getting to do it over and over again. And I'm curious, you said you guys are in rehearsal now?
This is another thing Paul Lazar, who performed the first one, is now the director. And so I've never been through this process before, and it's fascinating to me, you know, just to see how things change and how we collaborate on my lecture, which is now the script, and, you know, how things develop and how everybody pulls their ideas together to edit and change and tweak. And for me, who's been used to working by myself in a studio for years, it's really exciting.
What is your role then in the piece now, and how has that maybe changed?
It's interesting because in the first piece, my voice tells the story behind Paul performing it live. So I'm still present, but only in my voice. In this particular one, I'm sort of on stage, but to the side, and I manipulate all the technical aspects of the piece. I do the slides.
Slideshow.
And there's some live video feed that I do, and then there's a little bit of business between the two of us.
And so we have our dog and pony show, yeah. I like to call it, that we're traveling around the country. We've got a Northwest tour happening in April. So that's present. Future is another project about the Shakers.
Yeah, so...
Oh, I love you shaking your head.
I'm shaking up and down. I'm shaking
what up. What are the Shakers?
I was like, the Tell Shakers, I'm like, beautiful furniture.
Oh, right,
like.
Yes. What else? Tell me what else you know.
That's like...
Have sex.
Love it. No, you know, being celibate is not just not having sex. That's all I have to say. Well, what else do you know about the Shakers? She's 30.
That's
you're 32?
No, 33, but
so
yeah, 33. Same difference.
Go on.
That's it. Yeah. No,
Not many people know anything about that.
Just the furniture? That's all?
Well, I know that it's like beautiful furniture and that it's, you know, a religious group and relatively insular and some level like I'm like, is it Amish? Is it not Amish? What's the difference?
And did you know they don't have sex? Did you? Because that's important, I think.
Did I know that they don't have sex?
So you obviously didn't.
No, yeah. I mean, I didn't really, you know, honestly, didn't really think about it. But the furniture is so beautiful, you might assume that. Putting all that energy somewhere else.
That's exactly what their ethos was. That's exactly what their ethos was. It was a utopian community. And it was kind of religiously based, but it was more about the structure of a community. And women had equal power in the community to men, and I think that's one of the main reasons that they subtracted sexual politics from the game.
It was started by Mother Anne.
Yeah,
it was started by a woman, and she led it. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but what I remember is that the reason she has this celibacy policy is because she had a horrific birth experience, and it was so awful, she thought, this is wrong. It must be a bad thing. Because
shouldn't be like this.
Yeah, it shouldn't be like this. And so she came up with the idea, which in some ways had its own kind of internal logic,
mm-hmm.
that this must be wrong. You know, we shouldn't.
And a lot of people say, oh, they went out of fashion, or they died. The community died because they weren't procreating, but they lasted many, many years because they took in people who needed to be taken in, orphans, mm-hmm. women that had suffered domestic abuse and were trying to escape their situations where there were no outlets at that time. And they all, one thing, one very small detail of the whole picture that I loved is that they were an agrarian society. They were also a very capitalist society. They sold their furniture, seeds, they sold everything. So it wasn't like they were insular. They were really a public face in the community, not unlike Roberta's. And they would...
We're kind of flashy and sexy here.
Flashy and sexy. I know you're having sex here. I know you're having sex.
Not in the studio today.
They would always grow enough in the fields to feed their community, to sell, and also for people who would steal, because they knew people in the community couldn't grow as much as they did. So they would always make sure that they would have enough to, you know, pass out. But so anyway, I'm doing the Worcester Group, who is an avant-garde theater company that's been in Soho for the last 40 years. Working with them, Elizabeth LeCompte, the artistic director, Kate Falk, who's the queen of the Worcester Group, Cynthia Hedstrom, who is their managing director, and myself are doing side A of a recording called Early Shaker Songs. That was a recording of the last surviving Shaker women doing a cappella versions of the songs that they had learned accumulatively over the years.
Sure, like an oral history of...
Oral history. And we will be accompanied by young boys between the age of 9 and 11 doing marches and dances designed for the Fruit of Islam in Harlem by Malcolm X and his organization in the 1960s.
Wow.
What, their dances? Well, what are they like?
They're really codified. They're kind of like the Shaker dances. It was all about kind of presentation and display. But what's great when you see the ladies in the Fruit of Islam.
But you said it's just the boys, though.
Yeah,
right?
We do the boys and the boys. It's it's really strict. But inside that, they cannot help themselves. There is a wiggle and a waggle and a thing happening.
But there's a real prescribed sort of score that they
very,
do.
Very specific marching.
And it has something to do with religion and worshiping?
I don't think it's so much about religion. It's more about discipline. Oh. And I think that's what the Shaker movement was about, too. It was about discipline. It was also about the aesthetic. Help me with that word.
Aesthetic.
Not aesthetic. Ecstatic.
Ecstatic.
Thank you. Ecstatic.
You didn't need help.
You basically, after a whole day of work of building that furniture, doing the farm, milking the cow. Not having sex. Where do you put it? You shake it out. You dance together, but you don't dance together to get laid. You dance to get together to be able to sleep in the same room without a lot of people in the same house. You get it out of your system.
So when can we see that?
We're going to be doing showings of a preliminary workshop April 12th and 13th at the Garage, and then we are going to have our world premiere in Northern California, in a farm stand in Northern California.
So, are you going to have the 9 and 11 year old boys recruited from
each place we go? We're going to tour the world.
Careful, because according to modern research, the increase in hormone levels has changed the, you know, voice tenure of boys in that age range. You might want to consider going a little younger.
Oh, well, they're not going to sing. They're just going to
dance. Oh, they're just dancing. Oh, then they should be okay.
All they have to do is move. But don't you think it's a good idea every town we go to, we just recruit a few 9 to 11-year-old boys?
So it's just how many would you...
I would say, I don't know. Let's talk about it. How many boys can you get in a room and handle?
And do the, you know, Fruits of Islam, don't they wear like a specific like bow ties or is it
well
a uniform?
White shirts, black ties, and black pants.
Oh, that's going to be beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking about the young. I mean, I'm thinking if you came to my, you know, town of 2,000 people in northern Michigan and recruited the 10 boys, and like that's ultimately, could, you know, potential to be like a real kind of directionally like life changing experience to have exposure to a piece like that at that age. Especially if you're in a community where you don't have access to that as an idea, that something or someone would do, or a person in authority would bring to you.
Well, so Aaron, do you know? Have you heard about the property that the museums, the Shaker museums? So here's my ultimate goal. There's one near Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
Oh.
There's one in Maine. There are these beautiful properties. Who owns them? I'm thinking. They're kept up as museums. There's the housing. If perhaps the four of us could go around the country recruiting Shakers, all you'd have to do, it's only two things you have to do, give up sex and your free will, and come join.
Oh. No. I was so with you. I was like, on the road trip. I was like, yeah, I'm doing
all
it.
All you have
I'm
to do.
But Aaron, it's an agricultural society. It's based on agriculture. So not free will, not free will, just sex. But you can always
leave.
No,
now you're backtracking. So now you're making it look a little better than it really is.
I'll keep the sex and give up the free will.
Okay.
We're like toss a coin. Well,
see, already a loss.
We are just about out of time. Unfortunately, we have another program so coming up right behind us and pizza. So I want to thank you guys for joining us and definitely look forward to keeping in touch and getting a chance to see some of the work that you're doing and maybe take a trip down to Pittsburgh. Check it out.
Oh, March 1st.
March 1st. Yeah. Awesome. Great. Well, thanks a lot. You have been listening to the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. This was a special studio recording. To find out more about our 27 live weekly shows, you can find us at www.heritageradionetwork.org. Thanks for listening.